Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So tonight I wanted to talk about Buddhism itself and the myth of Buddhism and the history of Buddhism. I don't do this that often, and I find it so important to look at what is the story of the Buddha, what's the message that we get from the Buddha's story as it's told in the discourses, and what is the history or the context of the time of the Buddha? Why did he teach the way that he did? Because I think it gives us a really important, it helps us to look at his emphasis and the reasons why he taught, which will give us a little bit more instruction on how we can practice his teachings today. So that's what I want to talk about. The first part of the talk, I want to offer the story of the Buddha. I'm actually going to read it. I don't do this that often, but it will be about 5 or 10 minutes. And I want to invite you to really try to focus and to almost imagine, let the story kind of come alive in your mind. Before his birth, Siddhartha's mother, Queen Maya, dreamed that while she was sleeping, a white elephant descended from heaven and entered her womb. The white elephant entering her womb indicated that on that very night she had conceived a child who was a pure and powerful being. It said that when she gave birth to the child, the gods descended from the heavens and took the child painlessly from her side. The Buddha stepped from the side of his mother, taking 7 steps with lotus flowers blooming in each step, making a great proclamation to the world. I am chief of the world, eldest am I in the world, foremost am I in the world. This is the last birth. There is now no more coming to be. When Siddhartha's father saw him for the first time, he felt as if all of his wishes had been fulfilled, and he named the young prince Siddhartha, meaning he who achieves his aim. We'll call him Sid. Shortly after his birth, the king invited a shaman to make predictions about young Siddhartha's future. The shaman examined the child and told the king that his son would either become a great warrior and ruler or a fully enlightened being. Hearing this news, Siddhartha's father developed high hopes of success for his son, wanting him to become a great unifying ruler of the world. With this wish in mind, his father made it a point to shelter young Sid from human hardship and from the religious and spiritual practices of the world in hopes that he wouldn't be influenced to seek life as a spiritual mendicant. Despite his father's efforts, sometimes Prince Siddhartha would go into the capital city to see how people lived. During these visits, he came into contact with many old people and sick people, and on one occasion, he saw a corpse. These encounters left a deep impression on his mind and led him to realize that all living beings, without exception, have to experience the sufferings of birth, sickness, aging, and death. During his visits to the capital, Sid also came into contact with spiritual seekers who had devoted themselves wholly to a life of spiritual practice. Being inspired by the spiritual seekers and seeing how all living beings are trapped in this vicious cycle of suffering, he felt deep compassion for them and he developed a sincere wish to free all of them from their suffering. Realizing that only a fully enlightened being has the wisdom and power to help all living beings in this way, he resolved to leave the palace and retire to the solitude of the forest, where he would live a life as a spiritual renunciate, like those that he had witnessed in the capital. Having gone forth into homelessness, Sid sought out the best spiritual teachers of his day. He was especially drawn towards the teachings of Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, as they had developed very deep concentration meditations, leading to mental absorption and states of bliss. What he was primarily taught during this phase of his life was concentration practices like yoga and mantras. repetitive exercises of the body or mind that lead to one-pointed concentration and deep absorption. To his disappointment, most of the concentration practices he experienced ended up just being subtle forms of aversion, allowing him to ignore pain and confusion in his life, but not changing his relationship to it. It is said that he had meditative experiences ranging from total bliss to complete non-existence. Yet, when the concentration wore off, he was still suffering, still subject to attachment to pleasure and aversion to pain, still identified with his physical body as his identity, still caught in the cycle of sickness, old age, and death. Having mastered these concentration techniques, he decided to keep searching for the truth until he found complete freedom from the suffering of the world. He vowed not to stop until he found a state of mind that wasn't dependent on any temporary meditation technique. Sid's next bright idea was to break his identification with his body through self-mortification. He went off into the jungle and hooked up with a handful of other homeless renunciates who were doing various practices to prove they were not identified with their body. They had the notion that if they denied their physical needs, they could break identification with the body itself, the physical form, and thereby reach a state of non-identification and non-suffering. So they starved themselves, tortured their bodies, and tried to find freedom through extreme renunciation practices. It is said that Sid fasted for weeks on end. When he did eat, he consumed only morsels of rice or fruit each day. It was also popular among these ascetic warriors to go without sleep and to spend days standing without ever sitting or lying down to rest. Sid wound up emaciated and close to physical death, but he was still suffering, still subject to attachment and aversion, still identified with thoughts and feelings. All told, Sid spent 7 years on the streets so far, following the conventional practices of his time and mastering the techniques offered in the various Vedic traditions. And none of those practices had gotten him completely free. Now, close to starvation and still totally committed to waking up, he reflected back on his childhood, an experience of being at complete peace and balance as he practiced mindfulness of breathing beneath a tree. As he reflected on that experience and his ongoing battle against all forms of pleasure, Sid realized that neither pleasure nor comfort is the enemy. On the contrary, physical health and pleasure are wholesome experiences. Sid had experienced both extremes of life, from gluttonous attachment to pleasure in his early life to radical rejection of things, all things pleasant, from aversion to discomfort to attachment to pain. Suddenly, he could see that he needed to find some balance. So he left his ascetic friends in the jungle and set off on his own to find a middle way. He stumbled to a nearby river and sat beneath a grove of trees where he did sitting and walking meditation by himself. Once Sid had put a few pounds back on, he sat underneath a tree and vowed to stay there until he could see through the confusion in his mind. He was committed to not getting up from that seat until he had freed himself from all forms of misidentification, attachment, and aversion. Until he was totally free, he wasn't going to move. So Sid sits there, paying close attention to his mind and body, and he sits there and sits there and sits there some more, meditating on the causes of suffering and confusion, feeling his breath as it comes and goes, investigating the pleasant and unpleasant and neutral tone of each thought, feeling, and sensation. He opens his awareness in a more compassionate way, not trying to stop any experience, no matter how unpleasant it may feel, but rather meeting each moment with compassion and kindness. Many things happen to Sid that can be interpreted in retrospect as either internal or external experiences. A demon-like character named Mara shows up. Mara personifies all of the strong negative emotions that, when taken personally, cause us to suffer. These are experiences of lust, fear, anger, and doubt, to name a few. Mara appears and tries to tempt the Buddha to be off his seat. We can think of Mara as an aspect of our minds, often referred to as the ego, or perhaps, in Freud's language, the superego. Mara is afraid that Cid will see through the mind's illusion of control, and then Mara will not have power over him anymore. This Mara mind will stop at nothing to sabotage Cid's resolve and to be fully free from the attachment and aversion that cause suffering and dissatisfaction. Mara's first line attack is hatred, anger, and violence. Mara tries to expose Cid's attachment to pleasure by raining violence on him. Mara wages war on Cid, shooting arrows and throwing spears in attempts to deter Cid from his goal. But Cid continues to sit. Seeing clearly that Mara is only an aspect of his own mind, he radiates love and compassion through his being and turns the weapons of hatred into flowers that shower down all around him. Next, Mara attacks with lust. A harem of beautiful women dancing naked, arrive to tempt the Buddha to be with his desire. Cid continues to sit peacefully, reflecting on the fact that beneath the surface of temporary beauty is a bag of bones, flesh, and putrid fluids. He knows that the happiness he seeks will never come from a fleeting experience of sensual pleasure. He allows desire to arise and pass without clinging to it or identifying with it as personal. Feeling rejected and confused at Cid's refusal to accept their invitation of sexual pleasure, the dancing girls retreat. Cid continues to sit there, unmoved by the mind's insistence. Mara takes one final stab at Cid, attacking with the most debilitating weapon in his arsenal, doubt. He challenges and taunts Cid with criticism and judgment. Mara tells Cid he's worthless and conceited to think that he can be fully awake. Mara says, "Who do you think you are? Everyone is identified with the body, attached to pleasure, afraid of pain. How dare you try to be different?" Yet Cid has by now seen through his mind's limitations and has understood that by turning his awareness on the mind itself, he can see through the doubts and fears that arise. He knows that the doubts of Mara are not true. They are another phenomenon that arises and passes. To prove his resolve, he touches the earth to bear witness to the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, that make up all forms in existence. Mindfulness is the revolutionary insight that sets Buddhism apart from other traditions. Cid's main practice was investigative, compassionate, present time awareness. After the Buddha gained liberation under the Bodhi tree, he said in effect, "What now?" He was free. He had learned to accept pleasure as pleasure, pain as pain. He had seen through Mara's tricks and the ego's control and did not resist or attach to anything. After attaining enlightenment, the Buddha was not sure what to do next. He spent many days continuing in meditation, reflecting on his newfound freedom and the path that had led him to deliverance from all forms of suffering and confusion. With the path of awakening fully understood and comprehended, the Buddha considered sharing his insights with others, but he was hesitant because his revolutionary insights were so contrary to common human teachings and views of his time. He was pretty sure they would not be understood or accepted by the masses because they were so subtle or so simple or so contrary to the natural human instinct. To ask people to accept pain and a spiritual liberation that does not include bliss all of the time seemed crazy. He was unsure if people would be willing to do the work necessary to free themselves from attachment to and craving for pleasure. The Buddha reflected then on his intention to teach. As he was sitting next to a lotus pond, he saw that most of the lotus plants stayed stuck in the mud beneath the surface and the light of day, and some were barely breaking the surface, but there were a few lotuses that had broken forth into the sunlight and blossomed. The Buddha likened humans to lotus flowers. Out of the diluted mud of human existence, filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, in a world where wars, oppression, and lust rule the masses, there are those who can and will rise above the muck and emerge victorious against suffering. Being convinced that it would be a worthy endeavor to start a spiritual revolution, the Buddha decided that he must offer the path to freedom to all who cared to follow it. He thought of his ascetic friends that he had been practicing with in the forest and thought that if anyone could understand his radical teaching, it would be them. So the Buddha set forth to teach the Dharma. Last week, if you were here, I shared a little bit of my personal story of coming into Buddhist practice and what this path, what meditation means to me, what the Buddha's teachings have meant to me, and how my practice is showing up in my life today as I continue. And so I felt like it would be important in a lot of ways to share a little bit of the myth of the Buddha, this story. And next time I want to share a little bit more of the significance of that myth on his teachings, but I also want to talk about tonight the history. What was happening at the time of the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? Who was he likely from a historical perspective? Buddha, the word is derived from the word bud in Pali Sanskrit, which means to awaken, and is used as a title to describe anyone that has awakened. And so from a Buddhist perspective, there maybe are and can be many Buddhas. Buddhism didn't exist at the time of the Buddha. Really, the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. It's just a word that we use. Buddhism basically just means wake-up-ism. According to the Theravada tradition, which I'll talk about here in a little bit, or early Buddhism, the Buddha was a human being who, as a result of a sustained and disciplined practice, underwent a profound psychological transformation. Some people, scholars, theologians, refer to the Buddha as a radical psychologist, much more than a spiritual leader. Because the Buddha was so interested in the mind and how the mind creates and perpetuates suffering. The term Buddha does not appear even one time in the Pali Canon, which are the discourses, the early Buddhist texts. It's a title that was later, much later, attributed to this guy that we call Siddhartha Gautama. As a matter of fact, the term Buddha doesn't appear, but the word Tathagata is usually what's referred to in the early discourses. And Tathagata means the one who has thus gone. Siddhartha Gautama was the person likely born around 480 BCE. 480 years before Common Era, into northern India, which is modern-day Nepal, which was called at the time the Kosala region. He was born into an agriculturally-based community. His father was probably not likely to be a king, as it was told in the myth. His father was probably a feudal property owner. And so in a small or small-ish village, his father owned land, which made them relatively powerful people. His father probably had a role as an elder or a decision maker in the community and had relative wealth compared to the other people in the village or town. Siddhartha, important, would have likely been an educated person and would have come into contact with other thinkers from other cultures and societies. There's some speculation that some of the early Greek thinkers may have come into contact with people around the Buddha's own village and town. During the time of the Buddha, the landscape of the society and culture was changing drastically from republican states, where the states had power, to more centralized monarchies. And so there was a movement from agrarian and rural economy into centralized city economy, and there was a lot of people vying for power. The culture was really in turmoil in a lot of ways. Many people decided to break from society's standards, the class system at the time, and to pursue a life as a mendicant or a spiritual renunciant. And so the Buddha was just one among many people that decided to basically disengage from the roles that were ascribed to them at birth and to seek something else. Buddhism did not arrive in a vacuum. The Buddha both borrowed from and critiqued the spiritual practices and social and cultural structure of his time. Buddhism is an engaged practice with society, with culture. Many of the most important teachings that the Buddha offered were reframings of spiritual ideas of the time. If you read the early discourses, it can be somewhat confusing because he'll talk about Brahmins, or he'll talk about the Jains, or he'll talk about other religious traditions, and it almost sounds like he's ascribing to some of their beliefs. But a lot of times what he's doing is he's using beliefs in other religions and spiritual traditions to make a point. There are two things that he was very interested in, two critiques. One, he wanted to disrupt hierarchical standards for awakening. During the time of the Buddha, I'll get into this more in a moment, there was a very strict caste system, class system, that you were born into. And it was very clear through the Buddha's teaching that he could sense the oppressiveness of having to be born into a class where you were made to perform in a certain way with certain duties and roles for an entire lifetime. So he wanted to disrupt that. And he also demoted the role of the mystical, gods, rituals. He framed awakening as a practical matter, not a spiritual matter, requiring ethics and meditative practice to purify one's own thoughts, speech, and action. What the Buddha taught, he taught a teaching that was meant to be a skillful means for us to engage intensively with our society and culture, promoting both personal and collective awakening. And so I want to talk a little bit about this, his intention to disrupt hierarchy. I find it really fascinating that during the Buddha's time, Hinduism didn't exist as we know it. Again, Hinduism is a very generic kind of huge term to describe really a variety of different Vedic or early Indian practices. And so during the Buddha's time, there was something more, it's called Brahmanism. And Brahmins were the kind of higher or priestly caste of the day. There were really five classes. The Brahmins were the priests and the scholars. The Kshatriya were the rulers and warriors, which was the highest caste at the time the Buddha was born, and that was the one he was born into. There was the Vaishya, which is the merchant class, the Shudra, which is the labor class, and then the Chandala, which is the untouchables. Sometimes we know them as the pariah. During the Buddha's time, your class, what you were born into, gave you a place in society. The word for place in society is ashrama. That's why you may hear ashram in certain yogic practices. They may talk about an ashram. Ashrama means your place in society. Everything in ancient India has an order to it. And so this is why someone says that, I think it's John Peacock, he says, if you stand still long enough in India, you'll get deified. Right? Everything has a place. Everything has a role to a greater order. The word for order or cosmic order is rita. And it means your prescribed role. And even gods in early Brahmanism, you could just call it maybe early Hinduism, even gods have a certain role. So a lot of yogic practices and Vedic practices during the time of the Buddha, these spiritual practices were performed by Brahmins, which was this special class that you're born into. And their goal was a lot to perform rituals, to appease the gods, to maintain purity, to maintain the order of things, and to keep the order in society. Also, people practice rites and rituals to receive gifts from the gods. So kind of this idea that if you were practicing these rituals, you maybe would get blessings, special blessings to you. The message at the time of the Buddha was to be a good member of your class and hope for a better rebirth. So the idea is that if you act within the class you're born into, order is achieved, and we can all live, and you may notice where we get this word from, with something called suwastika, which means the good life. And so we see how later on, fascists took this idea, suwastika, the good life, order, everyone has a place. It's a pretty oppressive system. Even in ancient India, it was. Instead, the Buddha did something very rebellious. He taught duwastika, which that life is inherently unsatisfying. That all human beings, no matter what class you're born into, suffer. And that any human being practicing ethics, meditative training, could fully awaken. And this is a radical teaching of the time. Now, 2,600 years ago, there were still gender disparities. There's still a lot of exclusion from today's standards. And I will say, 2,600 years ago, for the Buddha to make the proclamation that any living being, any human being, from any caste, any class, born in any order, could fully awaken. How the Buddha taught? He taught that we did not need to perform rituals to keep the gods happy. That gods themselves, he kind of tongue-in-cheek said, are also in the cycle of suffering. Which was a very, again, pretty tongue-in-cheek and smart-ass kind of teaching. Carl Jung says, we don't awaken by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And this is what the Buddha was saying, is that if we really want to free ourselves from suffering, we have to look at the things that are causing it. And this whole idea that we just perform rituals and pray to the gods, and that we just believe that we're born into this place in society and we just got to uphold that's all delusion. And it's perpetuating suffering on many levels, personally, interpersonally, in our communities, and in the macro systems. And so that's what I'm going to talk about next time, which is why I wanted to set this up, is more about the Buddha's teachings on duwastika, the difficult life that we live. How the Buddha taught was also very original for the time, in that he taught with this word in Pali Sanskrit, ehipasika, which means to come and see for yourself. So the Buddha says, actually in one of the teachings, to give a little bit of backstory for this discourse, there are a lot of spiritual teachers during the time, and they would go to different villages, and the villagers would sometimes get a little bit frustrated and say, why should we believe you? The other guru was here last week telling us his teaching, right? And so they say, Tathagata, which is what they called the Buddha, they said, there are some spiritual teachers who come to our village and they explain and illuminate their own doctrines, but they disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. It sounds like politicians, right? They say, and then there are other spiritual teachers that come to town and they too explain and illuminate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. For us, there is confusion and doubt as to which of these teachers speak the truth and which speak falsehood. And the Buddha says, it is fitting for you to be confused, and it's fitting for you to be in doubt. Do not be satisfied with hearsay or with tradition or with legendary lore or with what has come down in the scriptures or with conjecture or with logical inference or with weighing evidence or with liking for a view over another or with someone else's ability or with the thought, the monk is our teacher. Instead, when you know in yourselves these things are wholesome, blameless, commended by the wise, and being adopted and put into practice, they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should practice and abide in them. So the Buddha's Dharma is not a code. One of my teachers, Ajahn Sucitta, said, the Dharma is not systems and structures. It's the wisdom that comes from using systems and structures skillfully. So we meditate. We practice something called the training precepts. I'm going to get into all this in the next few weeks. The training precepts to not harm, not take what's not offered, to be careful with our sexual energy, to be careful with our speech, to not consume things that hinder our ability to act in clear and skillful ways. We practice these things not as commandments and rules. We practice them as trainings to hold in mind, to reflect on. The word for meditation, actually, early on is not meditation. It's anupassati, which means to repeatedly look at. The Buddha taught a method of practice that encouraged us to repeatedly look. To repeatedly look at our thoughts, mindfulness. To repeatedly look at our speech and our action in the world, which is something we call sila, or the ethical trainings. To repeatedly look at our neighbor and to practice dana, or generosity. Not as commandments, because you're going to go to heaven or hell, or because you're going to be born again into another incarnation, or whatever. Not of another life. He never denied that there's a heaven or hell, or he never denied that rebirth was or wasn't a thing. When most people came up and asked him about him, he wouldn't speak on them. He would say, what are you doing today? How's it going in here? How are your thoughts? How's your mind? How are you speaking? How are you acting? And this is what the Buddha emphasized. He said that our actions rest on the tip of our intention. If we can really look into the mind and see clearly our motivations, we can free ourselves from the same repetitive patterns that are creating our suffering. I mean, I know for myself, I shared my story last week that there are many times in my life where I've had the awareness, why can't I stop doing this thing that I keep doing? Why do I keep ending up in the same relationship, with the same dissatisfaction with my job, with the same set of circumstances over and over and over again? And the Buddha had this really profound teaching. He said, your happiness is not a place later on. He said, your happiness depends on how you relate to what's happening right now. How do you meet pain with compassion? And what would that look like? How do you meet the excitement and joy in your life with appreciation, but without digging your claws into it? How do we develop balance? The Buddha's teaching is a lot different than what we're used to in the West. And I think it's important, not as a way to talk down on Christianity or what we're born into, which is this orthodoxy, primarily orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is a belief-centric kind of form of spiritual practice. And the point that I want to make is not to talk down on that, but to say that we're used to a way of seeing, which is very belief-centric. Right? In Greek, orthodoxy comes from the etymology correct opinion, and it means to emphasize adherence to accepted creeds. It's central to Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But Judaism, Christianity, and Islam also have practice-centered or orthopraxis relationships. So there are prayers and meditations and also practices in them. But Buddhism is primarily an orthopraxis, which means, in Greek, correct practice. Emphasis on adherence to ethical and public service. And Hinduism and Buddhism really emphasize that. And this is how the Buddha thought. The Buddha's Dharma is meant as a skillful means for us to engage with, as I said before, our society, our culture, and with ourselves. It's a practice, much more than a belief system. Right? What I find in my practice today is much different than I found in my practice early on. And that's what keeps me interested in Buddhism, in the Buddha's Dharma, in this teaching, is that it's the same eight folds of path that we're practicing. Wise view and intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. We're always practicing bringing awareness to these eight areas of our life. But what I'm finding is always new stuff. And I remember being in recovery, they talk a lot about like peeling back the layers of the onion. It's like you're always kind of finding more. There's more to dig. Maybe liberation, complete awakening is possible, as it's described in the myth of the Buddha. But I know, I feel with my connection to the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha wasn't interested in awakening over there. He was interested in many moments of ordinary awakening, many moments of clarity, many moments of checking our motivations, of seeing how we're relating to the conditions of our lives. And so I want to share just briefly, last few minutes, a couple bits of history on what type of Buddhism are we practicing here? Where does it come from? And so there are kind of two major forms of Buddhism. There's Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism. Theravada is a Pali Sanskrit term meaning doctrine of the elders. Sometimes they just call it old school Buddhism. It regards something called the Pali Canon, or the earliest recorded discourses, as the authority of the Buddha's teachings. It emphasizes meditative discipline above all else. And it talks about vipassana, or insight meditation, being the direct path to awakening. It's dominant in most, if not all, or sorry, in most, not all, South and Southeast Asian countries like Thailand, Cambodia, Burma, and Sri Lanka are the top four. So that's where a lot of Theravada and Buddhism lands. It's largely a monastic tradition, meaning mostly practiced by monks and not lay practitioners like ourselves. But in the 1960s and 70s, there was a Burmese monk named Mahasi Sayadaw. And Mahasi Sayadaw, seeing that the monastic tradition was dying in Burma, his colonization came to Burma, he made a decision to, for lack of a better word, really market vipassana and insight meditation to the world. And so he said, we got to get with the new school, guys. This kind of wearing the brown robes and walking around in the solitary lifestyle ain't going to cut it. We're going to die. So we got to start to teach lay people, non-monks, how to meditate. Mahasi Sayadaw was a monk that was sanctioned by the Burmese country to promote meditation, and he wrote several books on the progress of insight, how to meditate. And Western teachers in the 60s and 70s started flooding into India, into Nepal, studying Buddhism, and many of them made their way to Burma to practice with Mahasi. Another form of meditation is what we refer to as Mahayana. Mahayana in Sanskrit means great path or great vehicle. I call it newer school Buddhism. The initial split where Mahayana Buddhism started to come on the scene was around 300 BC, but it's really got its footing around the beginning of the Christian era, around zero. Right? So this was about 400 years after the death of the Buddha that Mahayana Buddhism started to kind of come on the scene. It's a tradition that's vast and venerates many different texts, including the Pali Canon. It emphasizes ritual, prayer, and many forms of meditation. Mahayana is focused primarily in East and Central Asia, China, Korea, Tibet, and Japan. Some of the forms of Mahayana Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, which was the first in America, originated around 500 CE, so about 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, Zen Buddhism came on the scene. Attributed to someone named Bodhidharma, who said it was said to have brought Zen to China. In the West, in our country, Zen is most commonly associated with Japanese forms of practice, but there's Chinese Zen, Korean Zen, there are a lot of different forms of Zen. There's also something called Pure Land Buddhism, which we definitely don't talk a lot about. Pure Land Buddhism originated in China in 402 CE by Hui Yuan. Does anyone know this person's name? I don't know much about Pure Land, but it emphasizes a lot prayer and devotion. So they usually repeat kind of the same mantra or prayer out loud, and that's the primary practice. It's very similar to more orthodoxy, like Christianity. A part of Mahayana Buddhism is Vajrayana. Vajrayana is Tibetan Buddhism. It's called the Diamond Way. Came around 500 CE, emphasized ritual and devotion, favors connections with deities as a way of expanding the bodhisattva vow, which is that the purpose of awakening is for the benefit of all beings, primarily. It's technically a Mahayana form of Buddhism, which is this later vehicle, but it's distinctive in its features and it's heavily rooted in Tibetan culture and tradition. And so what we practice in America is what some scholars call the New Buddhism. New Buddhism is a blend of the varieties of forms. It's mostly meditation-centered in the West and largely non-monastic. There's more gender parity, meaning you'll find a lot of male teachers, female teachers, non-binary teachers, more so in the West than in Asia. There's a cross-pollinating of Theravada and Mahayana sects, and it's both politically and socially engaged. And so my reason for sharing this is that Buddhism is a very unique tradition in that it was from the beginning socially engaged. It was from the beginning positioning itself against this idea that spirituality is mythical or mystical, that spirituality is for another world, right? Metaphysical. It's unique in that it was able to mold into multiple cultures and to let their cultures influence it, probably a lot more than it influencing their cultures. Very different than Christianity. It also emphasizes that awakening is an ordinary psychological experience that is not an event as much as it is a gradual practice and training. The Buddha has a discourse called the Ocean where he says that just as an ocean gradually shelves and progresses, so does this path of awakening. There's no sudden entry into the ocean. And so I like to share this for many reasons, but one of them is that the Buddha really emphasized that each of us can do the work that needs to be done to free ourselves from suffering in this world. That suffering exists in the mind just as much as it does in the world. And that we need to engage both internally with our mind, with our mental health, right, as much as in the world, right, with our society, our communities. And I want to also build on this. So next week I'm going to talk about the core teachings of the Buddha. I'll talk about the Four Noble Truths. And I'm going to talk about the Eightfold Path in the weeks to come. I just wanted to set the stage with some of this information, with the myth, the history. I'm interested to hear from you all, anything that came up, questions, comments, thoughts. We, of course, encourage you to speak, so even if you're brand new, you don't have to be an expert of anything other than your own experience.